I'm Al Sparrow, retired emeritus professor from the Department of Pediatrics and Human Development, and interviewing today Dr. Tom Johnson, former assistant dean here at the College of Human Medicine at MSU. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning.
All right. I thinking about interviewing you and realized that when we were closest in the terms of our professional work, it was toward the end of our careers. And I didn't know much at all about your early years and your journey to medicine and to MSU. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I took my residency in internal medicine in Ann Arbor at the university, and then was in the Air Force and returned to Ann Arbor for a fellowship year, during which time I really became enamored with teaching and had the opportunity to do it on several times. And I had an office rented in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, where I would have been the first hospitalist, as I look back and look at it now. But decided the opportunity came up to come to Michigan State, and I decided if I came to Michigan State, I could always go to Scotts Bluff, but if I went to Scotts Bluff, I could never come to Michigan State. So I started as an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine in 1968, June of 1968. And I got to tell you, Al, that those were really heady and exciting days at the College of Human Medicine. We were all about change. We were, and sometimes change just for change's sake, not with good reason for change. We were developing focal problems. The first summer I was here, we had a group of students, four or five students from Meharry, and we put them through a focal problem sessions. And the first class at the college was entering its third year, not traditional third year in medical school, but the third year of being in medical school, which was equivalent to the second year of medical school because of the fact they had a transition. It was a transition program from college. And we put them through focal problems, and we also had a general clerkship, a six-week general clerkship at the end. We had it in multiple locations, and it became my job, because there weren't very many of us. We were always about 5 minutes behind the students. It became my job to set up sites, and so I traveled out to Flint, Saginaw, Grand Rapids. Lansing pretty much took care of itself, although I was in practice at that time at Sparrow Hospital. We had students up in Elma, a number of locations. So that's really the early time.
That must have been very exciting and different. Can you talk a little bit about some of the other actors who worked with you and got this thing going and brought you here?
Well, I came here, knew Bill Weber, a physician who was at Ingham Medical, and came up to interview with him and actually came over and saw Scott Swisher and decided I really wanted to be at Michigan State and not in practice, full-time practice at Ingham Medical. That's actually how I got here. But I think the people who I remember the most were Hilly Jason, who was head of OMERAD at that time, the founding father of OMERAD. Peter Ways. Peter Ways and I became very close, and Peter was a fascinating individual who had given up research to really go into developing focal problems and everything. One of Michigan State's big problems, just reminded me, has always been that we never wrote anything up. And so although that focal problems, the idea of problem-based learning was really established here, we didn't get the credit. Other places got the credit because they wrote it up. Bill Weil arrived the same time as I did in 68, and Scott Swisher was here. Bob Bull. was, you know, in the Department of Medicine. Who else? Tony Baudler, wonderful researcher that Scott had brought with him. So, you know, there weren't many of us. There was no Department of Surgery. There was no Department of OBGYN. And parenthetically, I don't think Andy really wanted them, but he had to have them, and so later on they were developed.
Andy being the founding dean, Andrew Hunt. Curious, you mentioned Bill Weber, and that called back. Our careers have gone a lot of parallels, and I remember my first trip here, one of my first interview trips up to the school, and they sent me down to Ingham, and I interviewed there with Art Stanley.
Oh.
And in the, what do they call it, Greenlawn Group.
Yes.
The Greenlawn Group. So before I left, Art Stanley had a contract out for me. He's ready to hire me right away and put me to work in the Greenlawn Group. And like you, I decided, no, I really came to be at MSU and to have an academic career. So that was interesting. Was Bill Weber tied to Greenlawn Group at all?
Yes, he was at that time. And you mentioned Art Stanley, and not just an aside, what a wonderful man he was.
Yeah.
Wonderful man. I went for, you know, in the 3 years I was on the main campus and working out in the communities, I often went over to their TB sessions and things like that. That was one of my major interests, was tuberculosis. I have to say that one of the things I think is interesting is that I was about the only person, another person I forgot is Leif George Sirland.
Yeah.
You talk about wonderful human being. He was here, and I was about the only person who really practiced medicine, although George did, and Bob Doherty did a little bit because Bob was here. Bob and Sandra Doherty were here. But in an active practice, wow, I was busy. And Andy was such a firm believer in strict full time. In other words, so in a sense, I became disenchanted, because here I was not only doing all the schoolwork, but I was also seeing all these patients, hospitalizing them at the three hospitals at that time. And my salary didn't change. And so after the second year, I started to look around for other opportunities in the state.
The name of Bill Weber rings a bell. I never met Bill Weber, but as I understand it, he was taking care of a lot of the congenital heart patients, he and others, I guess.
Yeah.
Before I got here, and I was the first pediatric cardiologist in the area, and I think inherited an immediate practice from his and other people's efforts, mostly internists, I assume, who were trying to manage congenital heart patients, usually older ones, not newborn babies. But I never met Bill, and he left before I got here, I think.
Yeah, and I think he went to Flint, and then he was killed in an automobile accident.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I'd like to talk about the early days again is that, again, I went out and interacted, and Peter went a lot of times too, Peter Ways, with the communities. And in fact, I would go over for 3 days at a time to Hurley and stay there and be sort of a visiting, quote, professor, which was a kind of a joke. Here I was a runny-nosed little, you know, assistant professor, but, you know, trained in pulmonary medicine. And that was really fun. And Marshall Goldberg was the DME at Hurley Hospital, an intense individual, genius individual. And so later on, as the school developed, and I'm going to get into that, he became instrumental. The Grand Rapids, though, I would go over there, and they had three directors of medical education. Craig Boer, kind of a pediatrician, kind of a fatherly figure at Blodgett. Then they had Jack Pierce, who was an intellectual and touchy-feely kind of guy at St. Mary's. And then they had Fast Eddie Moorhead. And what a character. What a wonderful person. And, you know, he was at Butterworth, and he was unique. He was an oncologist, smoked Luckies, got up every morning at 11 o'clock, had breakfast, read the Chicago Tribune, which his wife had gotten for him, and ended his day at Ducks, a bar in northern Grand Rapids, to get the, you know, lay of the land, go home and work a couple hours. Talented man. And at one time, the house staff at Butterworth was one-third AOA graduates. I mean, he was a marvelous recruiter. But I'll be honest, I love being at Hurley, the big, fast-moving city hospital, but I fell in love with Grand Rapids and what they had to offer. Historically, Grand Rapids had set up a committee to have the third medical school in the state. And it was a very active committee. They did everything they could, but they lacked a four-year degree-granting institution, and it didn't go anywhere. And, of course, when I was, as an aside, when I was a resident at Ann Arbor before the Air Force in 1964, probably we were making rounds, and one of the individuals on rounding said, "I read in the Free Press this morning that John Hanna stated flat out that he didn't want he wasn't going to have a medical school at Michigan State." And the rounder, the professor, who was an old Michigan man, said, "Well, that simply means he's going to have one." And it did came true, but it was kind of a backdoor medical school because it was an institute of biology, human biology, or something like that. And it wasn't funded. I didn't realize when I came here that there were no dedicated funds, as I understood it, to the medical school. It was just money glomered from all different areas and brought in. And, you know, would I have come? Well, probably, because I was a gambler.
Was there any pressure on you then, as there is today, to generate funds from your practice, or did they pretty much let you do what you wanted in terms of practice?
The latter. Yeah. Pretty much. Al, you can't believe, you know, these focal problems. Honest, we were 5 minutes behind the students. We'd be over there writing crazy-like and getting it all set up and then run over, and they'd say, "You're late today." And, you know, and then go through the focal problem. It was truly heady. You know, especially for a young guy.
You mentioned the emphasis that Andy brought on the community and integrating with the community. How did these community physicians and community administrators react to you guys coming in and react to the concept of the medical school and the community-based med school? Were they friendly, inviting, or were they resistant and querying?
I think it depended entirely upon the community and the hospital. The model that was set up, and I think Don Weston had a lot to do with setting up the model. By that time, he was in the dean's office. But, you know, the idea that we would only interact with a community corporation and not individual hospitals, I think was genius. It really alleviated a lot of the issues and problems that we could have had playing one hospital off against another and everything, because everything truly was done in a open forum. Saginaw, because of its lack of success, my understanding, my lack of success in recruitment for house staff, had already set up a educational corporation, and that was easy. The other communities, there was some pushing and shoving, and in fact, here's an interesting fact that few people know, is that we had the first students in Grand Rapids, and I had moved there in 71. I'd taken the job in Grand Rapids, and we had moved there, but we hadn't set up the corporation we had been talking about and everything. So about in September, we were all invited, Don Weston and myself, a representative from the University of Michigan by the name of Neil Vanslow. He was a allergist who became later dean at two different medical schools. Interesting individual. I think he's a masochist because of the fact where he became dean, but that's neither here nor there. But we were invited to a dinner at Butterworth, and at this dinner was the chair of the board of trustees and Arkell Cook, a little man who was their administrator. And after dinner, they announced that they weren't going to join the corporation. And if we wanted to use them, we were going to have to do it on their basis, this and everything. We were going to have treat them as a separate individual. And they weren't going to do the corporation. At which point, this Neil Vanzo stood up and he said, "That's fine. But we believe in this corporation. The University of Michigan believes in it. And we're going to be a member of the corporation. And if you don't want to be a member, then what we'll do is withdraw all our support of all your graduate programs." And so there was some buzzing and whispering and everything. And they said, "Well, in that case, maybe we should consider joining." And so it was really the University of Michigan representative who pushed this.
That's unbelievable.
And got it to go. Well, Neil was a...
That wouldn't happen today, would it?
No, but Neil was a wonderful... He was a good human being, and I'd known him as a resident and stuff. Wow. But he also graduated first in his class at Ann Arbor. But so that's how Grand Rapids, in the Gramec, the corporation, really got started. I want to talk about another thing that I don't think many people know about. My understanding is that Bill Milliken, Governor Milliken, was very instrumental. His brother was a internist up in Traverse City. He's from the Traverse City area. And he was very instrumental in helping get the four-year school state-funded, albeit a deal was made with the osteopaths, who were at that time located in Pontiac, that they would become a state-funded school. And with the caveat that they had to join one of the three existing universities with medical education, Wayne State, Michigan, and or Michigan State. The caveat was that then CHM could develop and be state-funded. And so that after this announcement was made, obviously they didn't go to Detroit, although I think I'm not privy to it, but I think that would have been the DO's choice to go with Wayne, Wayne State. But Wayne State said, "No, we're busy enough." University of Michigan had already had experience because at one time it was half homeopathic historically and half allopathic, and they said no. And so it came to Michigan State. And after this occurred, Andy Hunt had a meeting in his office. And I was included, along with Ed Moorhead, the DME, Marshall Goldberg was there. I think Jack Pierce was there. I don't remember if Don Weston was there or not. And so Andy sort of said, "We would like to develop a four-year school. Do you think you people are ready to do that? Could you do that?" And obviously, they all said, "Well, yeah, we can." And then Andy blurted out, and I mean truly blurted out, "By God, then we're going to do it." And that was how the four-year school decision was made.
Amazing.
It was wonderful. And right after that meeting, I went to Andy and I said, "I want to go to Grand Rapids." He said, "Great, And so that's how I was here on the main campus, out in the communities for 3 years. And then I went to Grand Rapids to set up the corporation in Gramec with a lot of help from the school. So
the Lansing Corporation was rather slow in developing, wasn't it? That was the Ingham-Sparrow conflict, or St. Lawrence was in there too.
St. Lawrence was in there too, and Sparrow had what we referred to as the Sparrow Mafia. I can't remember. That's embarrassing. The CEO of Sparrow. Newman. Yeah, he
Carl Newman.
Carl Newman, and then there was Fedden Mavromatis and
that pathologist.
And the pathologist Will Maldonado, who when I came back, and that's getting ahead of the story, when I came back from North Dakota, Will was our best friend,
yeah.
You know. But at that time, there were...
It was the mafia.
Oh, there was another individual, a urologist.
Oh, yeah.
David,
yeah.
But they just did not want the school because it would be competition.
Of course, yeah.
You know. Yeah. Ingham was much more amendable.
Right.
You know, right. As I saw it. And St. Lawrence, fine, kind of shrugged its shoulders. We're on the other side of town, you know. And, but Sparrow was a real problem for Andy, you know.
It remains a problem today. It's amazing what goes around keeps coming around. Well, so much excitement in that era before you left, Tom. Why did you leave, and why did you go to North Dakota?
Well, that's getting ahead a little bit, because I left here because I guess I didn't really fit into the true academic mold. You know, in a lot of ways, I didn't. I found it much more exciting to be out in the communities and working with the communities, and so I chose to go to Grand Rapids. I just saw Grand Rapids as a great opportunity. And I was there 6 years. We got it functional and running, and that's not me, but the help of a lot of other people. But it was a dead end. I mean, they weren't going to turn any of their graduate programs over to the school. They belonged to the hospitals. Gramek was only an undergraduate educational phenomena. And, I mean, I could have stayed there, but it was kind of boring. So the opportunity in North Dakota came up, and I had been a consultant out at South Dakota in their development of their school. And so when this opportunity came up, I just found it, with a name like Johnson, you fit in wonderful in North Dakota, you know. They're all Norwegians and Swedes and other things like that. But I got out there and I suddenly realized now that I was the fifth person to occupy the dean's chair in a period of 4 years.
Ooh.
And that was reality setting in. But it was a wonderful time. I was there 11 years. They had me come out. They had a school since 1905, and it was a two-year school. There were a number of them in the country, West Virginia, for example, South Dakota, North Dakota, and several others. And they either had to develop a full four-year school or go out of business. That was the dictum. And so they were struggling to develop. A lot of political pressure against it. And 11 years I was there, I left. The school had been developed and was on its way. And that's not me. It's just that a lot of individuals work very hard. And, you know, I don't want to get into North Dakota because I could spend hours on North Dakota. But I came back because I feel that an administrator should look at 8 years, think about getting out, 10 years, get out, and at 12 years they ought to kick you out because they need new life, new blood, and new ideas. So 11 years I left to come back here and work with Don Weston, who was one of my closest and best friends in many ways. And so I came back. And there were some people who were very much against me coming back. One of them almost vetoed me, and that was Jim Pochin. I don't know what all the reasons were, but I had to go over to his office and interview with him specifically, and he said, well, if you come back, you shouldn't have any title. You should just come back and work here. And that was strange. I found that strange, and so I've always been a little wary of Jim. But it all worked out, you know. I did my job, and he did his in a magnificent way. He's a fascinating individual. But, you know, that kind of thing. And so when I came back, again, I came back as associate dean without any prefix. I thought that being associate dean was the best job in the medical school. I didn't have to take all the, you know, baloney that a dean has to take, and I can be out there doing what I want to do.
I was thinking that Don must have had to take on the poaching conflict. I suppose that went over your head too.
Oh, yeah.
And Don had his challenges with Dr. Poaching.
Well, but they really became, they were very good friends. And I think Jim, you know, this is just an opinion, but Jim really relied on Don for a lot of things, you know.
And really?
I think that as far as the operation of the school goes and everything was one issue, but they were good friends, and Jim really relied on Don for a lot of things. So we'll leave it at that. But, you know, a year after I came back and as associate dean, I was out in the communities again and everything. The communities were kind of disappointed in us because it was a impossible situation, because the school had developed here and the communities had expectations of Michigan State but could never articulate them. They expected us to, you know, be supportive, give them money, albeit not very much. But they always said, well, you got to do more. Well, I don't know. We could never articulate what more was. And so it was a little bit of unease, but they were doing a great job, all of them. We're doing a great job. All the campuses, Kalamazoo had joined by that time.
It's interesting. You mentioned, and I remember, that the flow of funds was from the school to the communities in those days. And that dwindled and dwindled as abilities for the school to do it. And now it's flowing the other way. I don't know if you're aware, you probably are aware, but the communities and the community hospitals particularly are funding programs and paying the school.
Yeah.
Complete reversal of funding.
I remember that, you know, you'll have to help me with some names, they hired a chair of OBGYN, Dr. Kirschbaum, and he was an interesting individual who flat out said, I have nothing to do with the communities. The school sends them money, they can do what they want in OBGYN. It's not my responsibility because I don't control the funds. And so the community did, and they did well, and leave it at that.
And they were totally separate from the Kirschbaum operation, you mean?
Well, right. I do think we took Kirschbaum tests and things like that, but yeah, we were separate. You know, he wouldn't have anything to do with us. Well, you know, the other chairs did have things to do with us, albeit minimal. It was a interesting time. I hate to say it, but you could pretty much do what you damn well wanted to do out there, a lot of things, and try some programs. We set up a program for two students, one of whom has done very well, and I lost track of the other one, where they made their own curriculum. And they hooked up with an outstanding general practitioner in a small town, small bedroom community town north of Grand Rapids. And they did everything with him, followed his patients to surgery when referred to surgeon and pediatrics and all these things. They went to all the lectures and they took all the tests, but they didn't go through clerkships as we knew it. And one of them ended up being, administratively, but he was head of the Indian Health Service in the United States. And so he was successful. And I think the other young man was successful too. But I got kind of kiboshed on that down here at the main campus.
So you were that was your milieu to run the student programs and particularly these special student programs?
Well, run the student programs basically and participate with the hospitals. I saw patients and helped in their residency programs, but their residency programs were their programs. They made that very clear. So I was also, when I was there, I rode as a training physician with the Grand Rapids Police Department for their emergency squad, and I was team physician for Grand Valley State Colleges at that time in their football program and wrestling program. And so, you know,
Are you back on the first tour in Grand Rapids now? Or
pardon me?
Are you back talking about the first tour?
The first tour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you were not in Grand Rapids when you came back.
No. I was here, but one of my major assignments was to be out in the communities. And that's when I talked about it being uneasy, you know, because they expected stuff. First of all, I couldn't deliver, and they could never articulate what they expected clearly, you know. So that was when I came back. And then what happened was I was here, and Don Weston, I think very inappropriately, got fired for his involvement. He acted as a psychiatrist and not as a dean. And I don't know how other people feel about it, and I'm prejudiced, but I think maybe for his involvement in this affair, that makes it sound, he wasn't in an affair, but this issue about this faculty member who had been hired, and then letters arrived about his inappropriate involvement with women, Don should have been given a letter of reprimand rather than being fired. But
people today consider that Don fell on his own sword, and that he took the brunt.
Yeah, he did.
And probably didn't need to.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But, you know, he, after Iowa, North Dakota saying he was lower than a snake's belly in a wagon wheel rut for a year, and Jim Pochin took him under his wing, you know, and he went over and worked with Jim. And then he got this job in West Virginia as provost or vice provost for health affairs and did a marvelous job, just marvelous job, and came back. And I should add at that time is that I was kind of amused, really. We had set up a vice president for health affairs at the school, you know, and that was another whole story, which I'm not going to get in. I don't know all the ins and outs of it. But so they were searching for a new dean, and someone who remained unnamed, in fact, two individuals who were connected to the search process came in my office and said, you needn't put your name in because you're not going to get it. And I said, well, that's only half the story. I wouldn't put my name in because I've already done that job and I don't want it, you know, and especially it's a tough job here because you got the osteopathic college and you got the, you know, MD college and you got even veterinary medicine involved. And I think it's almost impossible job here.
Who was that successor to Don? His name escapes me right now.
Yeah, from Ford Hospital. Came up from Henry Ford, I forget.
You know his memory either. And then this, he was not here that long. Bill Abbott was the next in line.
Right, that was when, yeah.
And you were still here when Bill was...
Yeah, when Bill was here, I was still here. And but what happened was Kalamazoo had fallen on tough times. It was truly an old boys club. You know, give us money and leave us alone was the motto of the Kalamazoo operation. And that was also involved their hospitals. The guy, good guy, Nick, was head of it, and he just... give us money and leave us alone. Well, they lost their residency in pediatrics, and they lost their residency, or going to lose it in surgery. And so the hospitals decided that they needed to do something. And so they fired Nick, and they hired a young man who I'd known very well, still know very well. He was up at North Dakota as head of rural health, Kevin Fickinger. And Kevin, you don't get in his way, because he is a builder, he's an entrepreneur, he has had a fascinating career, and he came in and really built Kalamazoo back up, got him to build a separate building, worked with Western very closely, and he, but he had one fault. They told him, don't do that. And he went ahead and did it, and they told him again that was about establishing a practice group independent of the community off of this corporation, the Kalamazoo Center for Medical Studies. And they told him again, don't do that. And he went ahead. And so the third time they said, adios. And it was real turmoil over there. And so Bill asked me to go over and... I said, yeah, I'll do that because I don't know all the reasons why, but I was comfortable. And Dan Mizuki up in the Upper Peninsula always said it's because you'd been dean and you needed your own show. I found that I'm just not an academic person. Going through all the academic fol de rah is not my style. And over in the communities, you go through the community decision-making process, which is much different. So I went over to Kalamazoo and was there 5 years, and I hope peace ensued, and I retired from Kalamazoo.
From Kalamazoo, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, had a hell of a party for me.
So you didn't have much of a home in the Department of Medicine. That was your clinical home, I suppose, but you didn't spend much time or any time there, or did you?
Well, I retired as professor of medicine here, emeritus professor of medicine, just like you, although I mainly worked in the dean's office. But working in the dean's office, I felt it was a conflict of interest to be deeply involved in the politics of the Department of Medicine. So yes, I kept in contact with the chairs, but and be it peripheral, but I did not enter into the meetings and the politics. They basically involved Lansing. The communities were kind of on their own.
The departments must have changed a lot from when you left to when you came back, and I would assume there was a period of growth there for all the clinical departments. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about how you saw that change and how it affected the educational system?
Well, I think that, I was a very prejudiced individual in that I felt that the communities were where the action was. And so the building up here of what I considered a more or less traditional medical school actually bothered me. I wasn't against it because I wanted the school to survive, and if that's the way it's going to survive, that's the way it's going to survive. But personally, I felt there should be much more interaction. I made the statement one time in a meeting saying that, you know, instead of being chair of surgery at Michigan State, you could be chair of surgery in the state of Michigan if you really involved yourself with those communities and their surgeons and things like that. And I'm not picking on the Department of Surgery. I'm just using it as an example. But the pressures here were real for those individuals who were chairs. You know, they had a faculty. They had people here. They had funding issues and problems. I've never seen the funding go up for the College of Human Medicine, not since the early days, you know, when I have to tell a story, is that in the second or third year I was here, Andy had extra money, and so he gave everybody who did something, you know, a $1,000 raise, which was continued the next year, you know, and that disappeared quickly. So, but
What do you see, Tom, in terms of the future of the college, with particular consideration of new medical schools? There's a lot of activity now. You know, there's probably going to be a school at Western, a medical school at Western mm-hmm. now. There's several other options in the greater Detroit area. And then there's all of the osteopathic proliferation as well. Do you see this as threatening to CHM, or are we going to be able to survive and or prosper? What would you see for the next 10 years?
Well, I was asked, I'm going to, this caveat, when I retired, when I left North Dakota, I go back, my daughter lives there, but I mean, I haven't been involved in the school in any way, shape, or form. And when I retired, which is almost 12 years ago now, I can't believe it, 10, 12 years ago, I left. And so I haven't kept up with all the machinations. I read the paper and everything, but I'm not privy to a lot of the issues as I was when I was first here. I'll just give you my opinion. I think the Oakland University Beaumont School has a chance of excellence. That's my opinion. I worry about Central and Western. Are they going to be private schools, in a sense, funded by tuition, which is frightening, in a sense? I understand somebody told me that the College of Human Medicine in Kalamazoo threw down the sword and drew a line in the sand that said, if you go to Western, we're out of here. Well, where are you going to educate your students? Because in my experience, the tough thing is your field, pediatrics, and the tough thing is OBGYN. Limited resources for medical student education, and especially in an ambulatory situation in pediatrics and in OBGYN. They're limited for a large number of students to have, in my opinion, an adequate experience. So I worry about the proliferation of the schools for CHM, because they're going to move into Saginaw, Central. I don't know where Western is going to go. Are they going to go out to Benton Harbor, St. Joe area? They're certainly not going to go up to Grand Rapids. But what are they going to, how is the CHM, with its increase in class size, going to educate its students? And is Flint, who has always had a antithesis to Grand Rapids, and they see this development in Grand Rapids, and they shrug their shoulders and say, well, okay, nuts to you. You go in with Grand Rapids, we're going to go with so-and-so. And the resources, and I don't know anything about it, but I'd lay awake at night wondering about it, wondering about that. I have a fantasy, and I'll just tell you what my fantasy is that knowing Grand Valley and knowing Grand Rapids, as I did, is the School of College of Human Medicine always going to be Michigan State's in Grand Rapids? Or in 10, 15 years, will it be Grand Valley College of Medicine? They're very political. Another university in Michigan refers to them as Xerox U. You develop a program, and they're right there pushing their own. They don't sit back, I can't help but think the constant being in their bailiwick isn't going to have some real consequences, or a shared school, or maybe Michigan State can pull it off. But you know, out of sight, out of mind is a true adage. I mean, if you're over there in Grand Rapids, are you truly a part of Michigan State? And, you know, you got to be here. I think that was the real strength, now that I think about it, the real strength of having the school develop here and having these campuses. And You know, that's what I've thought.
That raises the question I've had in my mind about faculty recruitment with this move to Grand Rapids. You and I both were drawn here by the challenge of a new educational opportunity and a new system and a wonderful opportunity for us as medical educators. If I were being recruited today, Tom, I would not come here, and I don't think you would either, because the future for this campus in medicine does not look very good unless you happen to be an osteopath. Would you comment on that?
Well, you know, I don't know enough. As I said, I left, and I have not kept up. But what brought me here, you're right, would not be here today. And you know, but you get different individuals. You get them trained differently. You know, I want to make a comment about medical education in the new schools, and maybe this is trite, but I don't think so, is that my main worry, and the University of Michigan, I think, does it pretty well. I worry about Wayne State and its huge class size being fed out to the hospitals in Detroit. But Michigan State has an opportunity to keep something in medicine, which is always doubt. In other words, I think students today, and I worry about the new schools, are being educated in a way of, okay, we got this thing, this, if it 1 equals 2 equals 3 equals 4, in other words, sort of a, I forget what they call it, there's a fancy name for it that make diagnosis easy. And once you make a diagnosis, you don't keep doubting that you're right. And, you know, besides being humanistic and caring for people and being scientifically trained, there's always, you always got to say, hey, am I right in this diagnosis? Even though it seems everything's okay and the Mayo Clinic said it was right, but is there something I'm missing? And I don't think, especially with the funding system we have now for reimbursement, that it lends itself to that. And I think we're going to get a lot of problems in care in the future. And my only caveat to people would be, know where your physician went to school and know where they trained, you know, and know what boards they have before you go. So.
Well, we're talking about the future and survival. You mentioned, will this or any other school become a private school? And I've heard that as well, as the state funding continues to decrease, gets less and less as a percentage of the total budget. Maybe many of these schools, if not all of them, in the course of time, are going to become private, i.e. they're not going to have state funding. Hmm. Does that ever occur to you?
No, I've never thought of that. But if I had... A digression maybe, but not. I had a wonderful opportunity after I retired, sort of a transition, to be a three-year off-and-on consultant at the development of the new medical school at Florida State. And, you know, they had limited state funds. And now everybody gets confused about a medical school or a medical center or an academic health science center, which is far more complex, but they were developing a medical school and had limited funds. And what we did down there was hire people, or what I proposed and what they did is maybe two different things. Again, I haven't been privy to it. But in other words, go out to the community that they were going to be involved in and find an individual who wants to be chair of pediatrics, pay them essentially a full-time salary, but have a job description which says, what do you get for that? And whatever they earn in practice is theirs. And you do that in varying degrees out in the community. It's a it's a nice way to go. And what the contract says is what they will do in medical education. And you can also that way set up that this school is going to have these strengths. And if you come here to do research or anything else, it has to be in these fields. Now, that's an idealistic thing. But I think there are ways to retain control and not be totally privatized with limited funds is what I'm talking about. What you're talking about is no funds at all. You don't have any choice. You're going to be private.
Now the CHM budget, I mean, you know, when you were here, it was 100% state funds.
Yeah.
And today, I think, I don't know for sure, but I would wager it's under 20%.
Wow. Wow, see.
Now, that's not all that decrease. It's an increase in other funds.
Yes.
Which has made the percentage less and less. So I can see in years ahead where it approaches zero, which is very worrisome, I think.
Well, I think it's very worrisome for the quality of medical education, because the description I gave you down at Florida State, those individuals who accepted funds, 5%, 20%, they were to assure the quality of the educational experience.
You had that control still.
Yes,
And that's needed. The osteopathic model is less controlling completely, as I understand it. I've not been in their system, but they use practicing docs without any controls. They just place their students in these practices and in these hospitals. There must be some investigation, some preparation, but no real funding, no real control of the process of what happens to the students. And the students come out pretty well.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the model we'll all be in as funding gets tougher and tougher.
Well, I think that what goes around comes around, and proprietary medical schools were the rage back in the 1800s before the Flexner Report, and some of them were decent, and the majority of them weren't. I've always been impressed with a remark saying that, I have a step-grandson who's a wonderful kid. Got a 4 point at Northwestern his freshman year, went out for football and, did things like that, didn't play, but went out and was a battering ram. And he's transferring up to Carleton from a first-class big school to a first-class small school. But he's thinking of going into medicine, and would I say, yeah, you really should do that like I would have back in the early days? Most physicians would say, oh, God, no. But you know what's interesting is when he enters medicine, it's the first day of his experience in medicine. If you understand what I'm saying, is that this is the way it is.
Yeah.
It's not what it used to be.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I'd encourage him to go to medicine.
So what it used to be is baggage, actually, for today's student.
Yeah. I'm not trying to bring this to an end, but I'm just saying that the opportunity here at Michigan State, the experience out in North Dakota, the experience back here, I've had just a wonderful career. Just a wonderful career. And, hoped I've contributed something. My dad was a dentist, but he was on the staff of Detroit Osteopathic Hospital as a dentist. And I've been interested in the history of medical education, and so I've really delved into osteopathic education historically and everything. And Taylor Still was quite an individual. He was a true entrepreneur. You know how it got started? He lost his wife and three children to probably a diphtheria epidemic out in where he was. And he was an MD, and typically decided that God, being a loving God, would not put people on the earth without the ability to cure themselves, and so he developed manual medicine, as they call it, or manipulation. And really, there were a large number of osteopathic colleges before the Flexner Report. And again, most of them closed. So they, I've always been fascinated by the fact that 30 years ago or so that there was a move in the state here, like there had been in California, to bring the two professions together. And I think the MDs voted about 90 to 10 to do it, and the DOs voted 90 to 10 not to do it, you know, because the size of the frog in the pond is still important.
Well, it's been a wonderful time reminiscing with you and hearing of your many, many happy experiences and satisfactions. Not to close on a bad note, but do you remember any major disappointments in your career and your medical experiences, medical education experiences, anything that stands out that, boy, you wish you could have changed or done differently?
Well, I think the major disappointment, and maybe it was one of the driving forces, was my inability to get the chairs out to the community. One evening, I was over in Grand Rapids by this time, and I had Scott Swisher, and George Serlin came over to my house, and then I had about, six or eight of the leaders in internal medicine in the community. We had my wife prepared a dinner, and we sat around, and we had a drink or two beforehand, and maybe that was my problem, but I really pinned Scott to the wall. And, you know, it's just saying, why can't you do it? These men are running, you know, the usual thing. And, oh, was he mad at me? Oh, he was, it was foolish on my part to pin him to the wall, just saying, why can't you do it? Because he didn't have a good answer. You know, that was when I was in Grand Rapids as the assistant dean for the first time. And when I came back, I apologized to Scott for my faux pas, and he said, I don't remember that at all. So, you know, it was much more. But I think my major disappointment, Al, was I felt that it would be better to be chair of the state of Michigan, which you had an opportunity to do, than chair at Michigan State.
I can understand that. And having been a faculty member going to communities and also been a department chair going to communities, I recollect the conflicts. And the biggest conflict for me was always 2 hours out of my day traveling. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of drove me nuts. I want your reaction to this. I remember, actually don't remember, I had stories that to get around this, Andy at one time had drivers to take people to the communities and so that they could work in the back seat. Did you ever hear that story, or were you exposed to that?
Maybe I did, but I don't remember it very well, you know.
So you could have had drivers, Tom, driven Scott down there, and he could have worked in the back seat.
Well, Leif George drove him down there, and Leif George told me he was really mad.
It's been fun talking with you. Unless you have any concluding remarks, I think we can wind it up, Tom.
No, it really has been fun, Al. Thank you for asking me.
Very good. Thanks a lot for coming.